I have too many brains to watch wrestling.
Oh, good. Okay.
I watch boxing.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Following Wrestling Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
And welcome to episode 97 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston, and today, going to be taking a most unusual look at the pilot for the television show Learning the Ropes from 1988. Originally aired September 18th, 1988, at least as far as you can believe IMDb on these sort of things. This is a show about professional wrestling in a way, starring a former NFL player, Lyle Alzado, who would go on to become infamous for something else a little bit later on. I'll get into that infamy more in a little bit when I talk about how Learning the Ropes was very much intertwined with the National Wrestling Alliance as a kind of promotional vehicle where the NWA, or Jim Crockett Promotions, more accurately, because this is pretty much 1988 JCP that is heavily involved in this. You'd see a lot of the wrestlers, and in fact, you're going to see some of them on this pilot episode of Learning the Ropes with some hilarious results, but not the hilarity that you would expect from, say, a sitcom, because when you got Ronnie Garvin out there trying to do comedy, You remember SummerSlam 89. Sometimes it really doesn't work out for the best. But first, let me get in my plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. And you're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And more on Pro Wrestling Only and all you can find there and all the great shows and whatnot coming up a little bit later in the program. And you also hear at the beginning of the show that, you know, a member of the Place to Be Nation family, and I would be remiss if I did not mention that I submitted my Place to Be Nation GWWE Greatest Tag Team Ever ballot, the top 100, and it was something that I'd kind of just done background research on, but hadn't really sort of put together the order until I went to go vote. And I was totally afraid of snubbing a team, but as it turned out, the only one that I felt bad that I left off, other than maybe Rybacksel, which, who cares, really? I mean, I don't really care about Ryback or Curtis Axel, and neither one of them made the list in any other team, was the Beverly Brothers. I kind of felt bad that I left out the Beverly Brothers, since they did provide some material for Greetings from Allentown in the past, and I should have found room for them somewhere in the 80s or 90s at the very least. So, without maybe I should do this over a couple of episodes and just read off like the top 25 that I have rather than going through the top 100. So here I will go from 25 to 16 with the tag teams as I rank them. So I'll just kind of this is not formal by any means, but this is how I cast my ballot. Number 25, the Rougeau Brothers. Number 24, Mr. Fuji and Mr. Saito. Number 23, the Wyatt Family. Number 22, the Twin Towers. And by the Wyatt Family, I mainly mean Harper and Rowan, but since three man factions are kind of being counted as one unit, that is what I intended. Number 21, Rock and Sock Connection. Number 20, British Bulldog and Owen Hart. Number 19, Terry and Dory Funk. Number 18, the Real Americans, that'd be Cesaro and Jack Swagger. Number 17, the Brainbusters. And number 16, which I may possibly be the high vote on, the Jumping Bomb Angels, simply because they had an insanely high batting average for the amount of time that they were around. So I do hope that you cast your ballot at Place to Be Nation, and I wish I had plugged this a little bit more in the last few shows, since the 12/31 deadline kind of snuck up on me, as, of course, as I had mentioned in previous episodes, I'd be attending the NHL Bridgestone Winter Classic at Notre Dame Stadium in South Bend, Indiana, between my Boston Bruins and the Chicago Blackhawks. Of course, this event took place 2 days ago. So what I'm going to do before I do the, you know, setting the table for learning the ropes, is that I'm going to throw it to myself in the field with, I'm going to call this, and I did this on my old blog, section309.com, dispatches from the road and just things that might be going on. Hopefully the audio on this is a little bit better than me recording from my car driving home on I-495 outside Boston. So I'm going to throw it to myself now from Indiana.
Back home again in Indiana.
Well, we got one day in the books out here in Indiana. And I would say that the most ridiculous thing that we did was flying through Chicago to get here, because it puts you into the central time zone, and then you have to fly back on this little commuter plane where we spend 47 minutes taxiing and 17 minutes in the air. But yet somehow the flight ended up being on time, because they have like an hour and 4 minutes allotted for this little flight. And that's perfectly fine, except for the fact that there's so many things that annoy me on an airplane, especially one from Boston to Chicago, such as this, because you got everybody with carry-on bags. They're going to try to get away with as much as possible, because you get winter clothes in there. And they were asking people to gate check bags for free, which I feel like is a pretty good deal, considering they'll charge you $25 before security. And that we had a 3.5 hour layover at O'Hare Airport, which saw us eating at not Chili's, but Chili's 2, which I call the aftermath of airport dining. This is in Concourse F at O'Hare, which, for those of you in the Chicago area, you might be familiar. It's a commuter terminal, sort of, and there's not nearly as much there as there are in the other places. But the most ridiculous thing that we saw was a guy getting on a plane, and he's in row 32, and he puts his bags in the overhead over row 22 when the plane was only about 15% full at that point. And then another guy, I don't know if he was with him, comes in from behind. Is like, oh my God, I don't know why they're telling people to check the bags. Maybe I should Boston accent this up, but it's like, oh, there's so much space in the overhead. And I want to be like, you dipshit. There's only 15% of the plane full. They can kind of look and figure this out. They do this every single day, and you are a complete moron. Just those, you know, air travel foibles that frustrate me. But eventually we get into South Bend, and we ask the Lyft driver, who's taking us to the hotel from the little tiny airport just west of downtown South Bend, hey, what is there to do here? And he's like, not much, really. And, okay, well, this should be an interesting journey going forward, if even. Although then the cab guy tried to put over, I think he wanted to start talking about places like Buffalo Wild Wings that might be in a plaza, or Red Lobster, which they do have a Red Lobster here, but it's next to a Red Robin, which is kind of funny. A very amusing zoning by them. This place is kind of interesting. Everybody is very polite and nice. And it's good, because that's how you can differentiate the people from Boston from everybody else. So, I don't know. That's about it for day one. I'll be checking back in a moment for day two.
Back home again in Indiana.
Greetings, everyone. This is the second dispatch from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, where my hotel room overlooks a through a pine tree into a McDonald's drive-thru, which, all things considered, it could be worse, except for the fact that I don't eat at McDonald's, although I briefly considered it for half a millisecond this morning because I recall liking those hotcakes that they would make back in those days. So New Year's Eve here in Notre Dame, Indiana, as the campus area is called, was certainly interesting as it was 35 degrees and raining for the entire day. And all the events surrounding the Winter Classic are being held in Chicago, and none of them are being held in Indiana other than the game. So we're walking around the campus just miserable as we can be for about an hour and 15 minutes. And the Touchdown Jesus mural, walk around the stadium, go into the Notre Dame Boyhood gift shop and all that other nonsense because it was heated and indoors. Eventually find your way to O'Rourke's Public House, which is on North Eddy Street, which is actually spelled the way the cool kids spell it, Eddie Guerrero, E-D-D-Y. Hang out there, which was pretty much the overweight, middle-aged white guy bar, if I've ever seen it. And we could kind of figure out that there were a few places down there that would be open past midnight. And eventually we find our way to Brothers Bar and Grill, very generically named, but opened here since 1967. And I sat down in there. Some of my friends were already there at about 6 o'clock. And we decided, you know what, we're going to stay here right through 12. And we had a table for 8. We only had 7 people, but then 2 left, so we had to go into the spread formation to basically preserve all of our seats. And then about 9 o'clock, we get the word, oh yeah, we're kicking you out of these tables because we're going to have a DJ dance floor. And while we were pissed off about that for a second, we realized, oh yeah, this is going to be a bunch of awkward people dancing to undetermined music. And it did get very crowded, but we found our way to a little cubby in the corner which had bubble hockey, which is something that, quite frankly, I dominate. And I won 6 games, not in a row because I want other people to have a chance there. But let's just say that, you know, I was the king displaying my Baltimore Orioles hat on top of the game for a little while during it. And that was a lot of fun because it was away from people, but you could still see the people for all that watching. And then requesting a lift at 12 o'clock and 15 seconds and being out to the car at 12:02 and back in the hotel 4 miles away at 12:11. Oh, thing of beauty. One of my proudest moments, even if I had to shove my way out of that bar the same way that George Costanza does when there's that fire, when the clown is there, Eric the Clown on Seinfeld. So anyway, that is it. I am getting ready to head off to the Bridgestone NHL Winter Classic at Notre Dame Stadium, where, because my friend's mother is here, we have a handicap placard, so we will be in that parking lot and getting a shuttle to the stadium. So let's see how that goes. Cheerio.
Back home again in Indiana.
I just have one simple dispatch for day number 4, as it's 4:45 in the morning in South Bend, Indiana. And this kind of falls under life lessons. Don't book a flight from a small airport where there are hardly any cabs or any rideshare at an hour of the morning where there's even going to be less of them. This is the final dispatch from my travels this weekend. It's a little backwards because I did make my flight in South Bend by the hairs of our chinny chin chin, getting a lift at the last second. Actually, I think it was an Uber. We were going back and forth, and I think I had to use Uber instead of Lyft because, well, you know, I got 50% off on Lyft. I didn't get 50% off on Uber, so naturally I had to use the one where I didn't get the discount. Fun hockey game with the Bruins 1-4-2 if you watched it on NBC. You may have also heard the concessions ran out after the first period, which I can confirm because nobody got any food pretty much after the game started.
but still a lot of fun, a great experience. And there were plenty of urinals in the bathroom. I'll say that about Notre Dame Stadium. They know that people have to pee, even if they're not going to sell them the water to make them go pee. So my flight is boarding from Chicago right now back to Boston. So cheerio, everyone, and I'm going to throw it back to myself back in the main studio.
Well, there you have it, spending New Year's in Indiana. I mean, what could be better than that? So back to learning the ropes to kind of set things up here. That if you go to the Wikipedia page for it, it says that there were 26 episodes of this show, when in actuality there were only 13 that I can find. And this is something that was inducted into the, quote, Wrestle Crap Hall of Fame quite some time ago, but I kind of want to play this straight to see if I enjoy it, because I'm approaching this like it's a backdoor pilot for my next podcast, where I do the same thing that I'm doing here, but with TV shows, where, like, today I'll be reviewing the episode of Mr. Belvedere, where Mr. Belvedere became addicted to pinball. You know, stuff like that. This is like a backdoor pilot for my podcast from Television City, as you hear at the top of this show every week. As an avid television watcher, I think back to all the pilots that I've seen over the years, and, you know, stuff like The Brady Bunch, Gilligan's Island, pilots that are not seen very often because they weren't part of the regular syndication run. I also think of the show Mad Men, and that being one of the best pilots that I've ever seen. I think that the title of the episode is called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, has to do with Lucky Strike and that account and all that. Now, this Learning the Ropes pilot, which is entitled Unmasking the Masked Maniac, it's not exactly that. We're not talking about Mad Men. What it is, a Canadian-produced show. So what you're going to see is a lot of Canadian actors, other than Lyle Alzado, who is an American in the lead role. He is the clear star of this during an era when you'd bring in these athletes to front these shows, and sometimes it would work, like the aforementioned Mr. Belvedere. You bring in Bob Uecker. Look, we got Uecker. We got to give him a vehicle he can drive. So you put him on the ABC television network on Friday nights. You have a sassy British butler, and magic happens every single week. With Bob Golic and Saved by the Bell, the new class, not so much with him playing the RA or whatever it was. Although, to be fair to Saved by the Bell, the new class, Tiffany Amber Thiessen on that show, possibly the hottest woman who has ever appeared on television during that one season that they ran. I'm not talking about Valerie Malone. I mean specifically Kelly Kapowski from the years 1993 and 1994. But back to Learning the Ropes and Lyle Alzado, who did have a pretty lengthy NFL career dating from the early 70s all the way to the 1985 season, and then an aborted comeback after Learning the Ropes was canceled in 1989 when he was 40 years old at that point and well past his sell-by date. He had probably the most notoriety, I think, for playing for the Los Angeles Raiders, which was at the end of his career, but he was also on some decent Cleveland Browns teams, including one in 1980 that should have gone to the Super Bowl, and he also went to the Super Bowl with the Denver Broncos after the 1977 season. He came into the league from a small school in South Dakota. It was called Yankton College, which sounds like a euphemism for masturbation, if I've ever heard one. But he goes on, has a long career in the NFL. He does get some acting gigs along the way. So it's not as if they said, we got to have a Lyle Alzado-fronted television show, and we've got to do it in Canada, and he's got no acting experience. He had done spots on other shows in the past. But there was high hopes for what they were doing here, and there was an LA Times article that came out shortly after this show hit the air, entitled Alzado Now Learning the Ropes as an Actor. Now, as I mentioned, this show was produced in Canada as a Canadian television show, so you're going to see the kids are both Canadian actors, but it was syndicated to the United States, which is where I believe the tape of this was pulled from and then posted to YouTube. It says, Alzado now learning the ropes as an actor from the Los Angeles Times, which makes sense considering that he had finished his career with the Raiders. Quote, I can get to the bathroom on Monday morning without crawling, said Alzado, who was described by one sports writer as, quote, a belligerent bearded Hell's Angel in cleats when he retired in 1986. Three seasons removed from football, that's no longer true. Alzado is an actor portraying a bearded, belligerent professional wrestler known as the Masked Maniac in the syndicated television series Learning the Ropes. Actually, that's only half of it. Alzado's character, Robert Randall, is also a single parent raising two kids, working days as a high school teacher and nights as a challenger against the Road Warriors and Ric Flair. The only problem is, when people hear Lyle Alzado is going to play a high school principal, they get a little leery, said Alzado, whose show was in its first season. You know, the old cliches, the football player is this, the football player is that. But this role gives me greater range to develop my acting ability, to develop more depth, foundation, and strength. I always love when guys talk about the craft, especially when they're not like real. I don't want to say that he's not a real actor or anything, but he was a football player first who was dabbling in acting. And that's, you know, more or less what it is. So yes, it is the story of a teacher at a private school, which is important for reasons that I'm going to get to in the review, because there was a question that I had about something that was in this pilot. And he is raising two kids, conveniently a boy and a girl, while moonlighting as the masked maniac on the side and keeping it a secret from everybody involved, because God forbid they find out that he's a wrestler at the school, they'll probably, you know, have him fired or something like that. You can't have that at a private school. And in fact, he keeps it from his children at first, but we'll see where that goes. And you'd best describe him as a lower mid-card talent at best. They say he's taking on Ric Flair and the Road Warriors. And yeah, while you see him in the ring with those guys in various episodes, it's not like, you know, he was working a program with any of them. Think of him perhaps as like the Coco Beware level, and, you know, as that character is on this show. Now, the kids on this show, his children, are students in the school. And both of the actors have kind of an interesting history. And the girl, who is named Ellen Randall, is played by Nicole Stoffman, who might be best known as sort of being a child version of Shelley Long up in Canada. And Shelley Long left Cheers after five seasons, which thank God she did, because that show was suffocating under her at that time. And Nicole Stoffman left the show called Degrassi, or Degrassi High, as it's sometimes known, which is a Canadian series that's had many incarnations over the years. And for Americans, you might think of it as kind of like Saved by the Bell, in that Saved by the Bell had the college year, as I mentioned earlier, the college years, the new class, and just keep trying to reinvent that. And I think that there's a Degrassi show on Netflix that is posted there now. So I assume it's still a Canadian-produced show, kind of in the vein of Schitt's Creek, which is also a Canadian-produced show that is on Netflix that I watch and enjoy. Now, Nicole Stoffman left Degrassi after two seasons to be in Learning the Ropes, so maybe not the best career move for her, but she has landed on her feet as a jazz singer in the Toronto area. And the next time I'm in Toronto, I need to seek her out and see her act, because I certainly would enjoy going to a jazz club. It would be something different for me. A change from my usual walking between four bars in one night and then eating 60 oysters in one sitting. I feel like that would be healthy for me. The boy on the show, Mark Randall, is played by a fairly high-profile actor for Canadian television, Yannick Bisson, who, very long career on Canadian television as the star of Murdoch Mysteries, which had me excited because I thought it was based on Dick Murdoch, but he has played the character William Murdoch on that show since 2008. I want to say that there's like 170-something episodes of that show out there. He was also the voice on a kid show, The Adventures of Napkin Man. I don't really know much about that, although I certainly I love the name Adventures of Napkin Man. What kind of a superhero is that? It is actually more of an educational thing to teach children about coping with feelings and emotions in their life. So I'm not going to crap on it too much. As a kid, he appeared in commercials in the late 70s and into the early 80s before he had his breakout role. And when I saw that the guy from Learning the Ropes was also in this other Canadian movie that I love from 1984, a CBC movie of the week called Hockey Night. I had a tape of this movie as a kid that I watched the hell out of. And I remember Spear Kozak, who was played by Yannick Bisson, and the girl played by Megan Follows, whose name was Kathy Yarrow, who had moved to Parry Sound, and she tried out for the junior bantam team. And there was a lot of issues with a girl trying out for a boys team, which, by the way, coached by Rick Moranis, the same year that Ghostbusters comes out. Rick Moranis is a hockey coach in this other movie that you only saw in Canada, and I'm pretty sure that nobody remembers this, and it's to the point where I need to order the DVD for this off Amazon, because I need to watch this movie again, because I probably watched it 30 times as a kid.
Come on, you guys, come on! Where's the game?
Up here!
Yeah, what's the word?
Liar!
Yeah, come on, and who are we?
Number one!
Who are we?
Number one!
Now, they're chanting something. I can't quite make it out from up here. We'll be right back after this commercial message. What's going on?
I think it's called a strike, though. Strike before. Well, unofficially, I'd say it's for the girl.
So, yes, he was the best player in that movie, and he was the one kind of striking on behalf of the girl who was kind of tossed off the team at a point in the movie. I also, there's one line in Hockey Night where somebody is making a stern speech to the team in the locker room and says something like, you'll get something that nobody can take away from you. And somebody just yells out, herpes, and everybody starts laughing. I always like that particular bit. So that was his first break, and he's actually kind of a big deal on Canadian television. I don't know what like the TV ratings are up there, but if you carve out a career over this many years, then you've really accomplished something. It's kind of like the Kane corollary, to draw it back to wrestling. Now, for Learning the Ropes, if you were hoping to see this show, it is not available on DVD anywhere, probably because Yannick Bisson might want to scrub this entire thing from his resume, and perhaps a mistake for all involved. As I did mention, it aired in syndication in the United States, so what we have is people who taped the show off TV who have digitized it and can post it to YouTube. Now, it's probably not multiple copies, probably the same copy floating around. I think that there are two of them on YouTube. So when does the NWA come in on this? They saw it as a promotional vehicle to put their guys on this show. Ric Flair is in the pilot. As I mentioned, Ronnie Garvin is as well, to kind of get them to promote the brand. But honestly, this is not exactly the WWF on MTV. The production values, which there were some issues that I may be getting into later, that are not quite up to snuff. Lyle Elzado actually appeared on Clash of the Champions 2, which would have been a couple of months before this show actually premiered, to promote Learning the Ropes. It's a clash that I mainly remember for the angle that they recorded on Chicago Blackhawks owner Bill Wirtz's boat, of all places. So this didn't really work, and of course Crockett was in the middle of huge financial issues by the end of 1988, selling to Ted Turner. Eventually Learning the Ropes would go off the air in early 1989. Not exactly the greatest thing for Nicole Stoffman's career, Yannick Bisson's career, you know, chugs along, and Lyle Elzado eventually passes away a couple of years later from cancer that he blamed on steroid abuse. Now, there's a lot of, you know, issues with that. in terms of the science. He kind of, you know, was connecting dots that weren't necessarily there, in that the steroids themselves wouldn't clinically cause the cancer that ended up killing him. The steroids probably were not good for his body in the long term, but if steroids caused cancer the way that Lyle Alzado was insinuating, Billy Graham probably would have died in 1979. Instead of still being with us. And God, I hope he doesn't die between the point where I record this and the show is actually released. But I think I'm going to enjoy reviewing this, because this is a Canadian sitcom pantomiming a bad American sitcom. However, just because it's bad doesn't mean I'm not going to enjoy it. I think I enjoy bad sitcoms a hell of a lot more than I enjoy bad wrestling shows. I don't go out of my way to watch WCW 2000 because I've always said in the past, life's too short to watch bad wrestling. But I always have time for any sort, any manner of horrible 22-minute sitcom. So let's just jump right in.
Tonight, Larry Bird no longer is a Celtic. News 4 has just learned that Bird will take the head coaching job with the NBA Indiana Pacers.
That news comes just hours after Rick Pitino made his first Boston appearance as the new Celtics coach this afternoon at the Fleet Center. So Rick is in and Larry is out.
The Rick Pitino era officially begins.
Larry Bird's not walking through that door, fans. Kevin McHale's not walking through that door, and Robert Parrish is not walking through that door. And if you expect them to walk through the door, they're going to be gray and old.
I'm sure the Rick Pitino era with the Celtics would have gone a little bit better starting in 1997 had they won the Tim Duncan lottery. But considering the way he drafted and traded, it's not. I don't think Tim Duncan would have stayed around past his entry-level contract, is just the hunch that I get. Because Duncan almost went to Orlando in 2000 anyway, and he ended up staying with the Spurs, obviously, for his entire career. I mean, instead, the Celtics draft Chauncey Billups, trade him after 50 games, and Pitino literally goes on his own show on WBZ4 in Boston and says, "We weren't giving up on Chauncey. We thought he was fantastic." Then they trade a first-round pick the next year for Vitaly Potapenko, I think his name was. It was not good times around here at that point. A lot of people talk about how great of a trader Danny Ainge was. Rick Pitino, a charlatan of the highest order, and I think the last few years have kind of bared that out. At the top of the show, I played a little bit of the opening theme to Learning the Ropes, which is very 1980s sounding. And it does sound a little too familiar to me. If you listen to it, it's got a little bit of Family Ties and a little bit of Who's the Boss and a dusting of other shows. And you get the little clips with the credits with them doing like two or three wacky things and then their name. It's classic stuff. Learning the ropes. Learning the ropes. The ropes just reminds me a little too much of the Family Ties. Sha la la la.
Sha la la la.
Learning the ropes. I've been walking around for over a week now, just kind of humming to myself, learning the ropes, and then just kind of making up lyrics. I've been singing it in the shower, for God's sakes. Something really wrong with me, but it is kind of its time. This particular theme song. Like I said, I like the quirky two or three things that they show each of the characters doing. And then we get me, it fulfills a lifelong dream of a Ric Flair flop appearing in an opening sitcom credit sequence. It's so great. But we actually do get to see it in the pilot episode. It's so, so hilarious. Learning the ropes. Sha la la la. I've got to pull myself together if I'm going to make it through this episode. And we start out the son, Mark. He's watching wrestling and eating cereal. I don't know if this is sort of a Canadian thing, but he's pouring the milk out of what appears to be an open container rather than kind of a plastic jug. I don't know if they still have like the milkman delivery model where they are or what the story is. And he's watching wrestling not on an over-the-top device, like we take for granted now these last few years, whether we're watching the award-winning WWE Network, Fight TV, or whatever it is. Instead, he's watching it old school on a borrowed tape from a friend. And the match that he happens to be watching is Arn Anderson taking on the Masked Maniac. Now, we'll get more into the Masked Maniac a little bit later because we get to see him in a couple of different matches during this show. And Arn scores with a shoulder block, but then he goes for his DDT that he usually goes down with quick, but he doesn't quite execute on it, and he ends up falling on his back. And the Maniac ends up grabbing Arn's leg and starts biting it. And another great thing about this, and this is probably something that's really common when you see pro wrestling portrayed in these sitcoms, is the ultra cheesy announcer who makes Eric Bischoff sound like Gordon Solie.
He should be thrown out of the human race. He's biting him. The Masked Maniac is eating human flesh. All right, chew him up.
So now Lyle Alzado, the dad, Robert Randall, he comes walking down the stairs. He sees that his son is watching wrestling, so obviously he's going to have a negative reaction to this.
Can't you do something more constructive with your time?
This is a learning experience. Learning all the ways the human body will bend. I don't want you to watch wrestling. What could you possibly have against it?
I'm a father. I don't need reasons.
Oh, how?
I have to say, that's pretty realistic, considering how many of us have to keep our fandom secret from either family, friends, or whatever. But it's kind of interesting that literally less than 3 minutes into the pilot of this wrestling-themed TV show, we're already crapping on wrestling in a certain way that is kind of based in a certain reality. So now the daughter, Ellen, is asked if she's ready for school, but she hasn't quite made herself up yet.
Ellen, honey, you ready for school?
I just have to put my makeup on.
Honey, you don't need makeup. You're just naturally beautiful.
Dad, with makeup on, I look more like Madonna.
With makeup on, you look more like Michael Jackson.
I don't know, I'd say that was a fair reason for Ellen to want to put makeup on. I mean, Madonna 88, maybe not my favorite version of her, but she was plenty hot then. She had the really dark hair at that time, and it was before she went all into, like, the, you know, the sex book and stuff like that. I think that Michael Jackson thing was a bit of a cheap shot, and I don't think that the laugh track there was entirely necessary. So brother and sister bicker over everything. You know, this all sounds very familiar to me as a younger brother, although he's the older brother, so I guess it is slightly different. But Mark is not allowed to hang out at his friend's house for whatever reason. I don't know if it's because he loaned him the wrestling tape or whatever. So instead, he asked for a raise on his allowance, which he had just gotten the day before. But Robert answers back with some classic TV dad fatherly advice.
What does J-O-B spell?
Job?
No, job. Get one.
There's that great sense of communication again.
No, Dad, you're putting a lot of pressure on me.
Glad to do it, son.
I call it tough love. You see, you come to me and you say, Dad, I need an advance on my allowance. And I say to you, tough. You know, being the son of an impoverished teacher is a real bummer.
I know.
Ellen, let's go.
Coming.
Special kind of ironic that you have the Masked Maniac, Robert Randall, talking about J-O-B when he is doing the J-O-B on the side to bring in more money, which is what his son is asking for. There's something really weird about Lyle Alzado's acting that I'm noticing, not only in the early stages of this show, but all the way through it in how he delivers his lines in a somewhat psychotic fashion, where it'll sound maybe a little stilted during it, but then as it builds up to the end, he's going to go all bug-eyed, like a Rodney Dangerfield punchline or something like that. But when he does it, it's rather psychotic and makes me think that there's some sort of roid rage perhaps coming. Now, overacting, I don't have as much of a problem with it if it's a kind of a stage theater sort of thing. I mean, an example from sitcoms around this time is Mark Lynn Baker on Perfect Strangers. He's certainly not a classical TV actor because he was kind of projecting outward like you would on stage in a theater. But Lyle, you know, I don't think he's quite that trained for that. So back to the issue at hand is that Mark, he's kind of struggling with the fact that he's in a rich kid douchebag private school with a bunch of trust fund a-holes who just kind of sponge off their parents and their trust funds and that sort of thing. So he feels peer pressure that him getting a job actually makes him stand out as being beneath the others. So I can understand it from that perspective. However, I also get that you have a single father as the head of household here. So if he went and got a job to help support the family unit, that would probably be a good thing in the long run, Mark, instead of sitting around watching wrestling tapes. I know we'd all like to do that, but, you know, go out there and earn your keep. But he does try to suck up to good old Dad.
You know, Dad, despite all of this abuse, I still love you.
And I love you, too. But the answer is still no.
I know. It was worth a shot.
Robert's parenting style kind of raises a few more questions for me. Did he only become as strict as he is once he became a single parent? Was this something that may have led to the breakup of him and his wife? I don't know. These are things that maybe they do get explored in the following 12 episodes. I don't know. I've only watched the first 2.5. But I will continue through it because I want to learn more about the psyche of this guy.
Boy, this is a nice kickoff. Desmond Howard has to back up. Can't get the run from the goal line to the 5, to the 10, to the 15. Through a hole to the 20, to the 30, outside, to the 40. He may be gone. Midfield, gone. To the 40, the 30, the 25, 20, the 10, 5. Touchdown for Desmond Howard.
Holding number 95 on the return team. That's a 10-yard penalty from the spot of the foul. First down, Green Bay. Those are the words you should have heard from the referee in Super Bowl 31. But, oh, it went uncalled because McKenzie there, oh, he's only holding the kicker. But that kicker, Adam Vinatieri, only weeks before this, had actually run down Herschel Walker in a regular season game, which to this day, it cracks me up because Adam Vinatieri still in the NFL and he once made a tackle on the 1982 Heisman Trophy winner. It's like one of those degrees of separation thing, like how Ray Bourque played against Gordie Howe and Ray Bourque played to 2001 and Gordie Howe was a rookie in 1946. But yeah, Adam Vinatieri was held on the play. And it would not be the last time that a non-call on a holding penalty would hurt the Patriots in a Super Bowl. So anyway, we're back at school now. So we are in the actual place where Robert Randall teaches, which is Ridgedale Valley Prep. Kind of a generic name there, but I can go along with it. The use of valley, I want to say that that's definitely something of a nod towards Back to the Future, or something like that. So we do a awkward cut, and I can't explain some of these where the audience laugh track is going on as that cut is being made. That is a little strange. But we meet the principal of this school, whose name is Whitcomb Mallory, which sounds like another Family Ties homage, with Mallory being the last name. It's a pretty neat name there, Whitcomb Mallory. Not quite to the level of Buford T. Justice from Smokey and the Bandit, but it'll have to do. And he is with Carol Dixon, who is a language teacher at the school, who was kind of a would-be love interest for Robert that seems like something that they scrapped but was on the drawing board very early. So Whitcomb Mallory's, you know, his docket is a little full these days, so he's looking to get some help, and I'm kind of scratching my head on some of this.
I find that I've been spending so much time and effort on fundraising that my duties as principal have suffered. Hence, I have decided to alleviate that problem by creating the new post of vice principal.
That's some hensing.
My choice is a difficult one because it's between the two of you.
The first thing that confuses me is the notion that this school never had a vice principal before. which it's not something that they invented in the late 80s. You know, you'd have a principal and a vice principal at any high school worth its salt, whether it be public, private, whatever. Now, this is not how it would go down if this was a public school, because there is a whole process for that sort of thing. You have to work it out with the union, who has qualifications. I don't know if it's subject to a lottery. It might be in some cities where the person with seniority would have the first crack at this job or right of first refusal. But private school, a little bit more freewheeling, so he can just nail it down to, oh, I can hire my relative, or I'll hire this guy who is just a teacher here. And what's really funny about this is she actually defers this to Robert, which kind of an odd thing by Carol, until you start to get the sense that she really has some feelings for him.
Oh, give it to Robert, Uncle Wickham. I think he'd make a wonderful vice principal.
Well, what do you say, Randall?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I could use the extra money.
Money? Surely you jest. All that comes with the job is the honor and glory of working side by side with me. Well, that, and you may become known as a big Mr. Chips.
Sorry, not interested.
Oh, all right, there's money. You'll get a nice big office, a computer, your own private parking space, and a substantial raise. Hell, that sounds so good, I'll take it myself. Forget it, Randall. Back to work.
All right, so are you offering him the job or not? I don't quite get you, Whitcomb. Like, why would you come in there and do that whole speech and then be like, oh, I'm just going to take it all for myself? Kind of, I'm really confused by the fact that there wasn't a vice principal in the first place. It's like how in the movie Major League, Charlie Donovan is the general manager, and they're already inviting guys to spring training, so it's going to be late in the off season, and he has no idea who the manager is going to be and is asking Rachel Phelps who's going to be the manager. Like, how does the GM not have say over that? I better save that for the Major League podcast. So we established that Carol and Robert Randall have some sort of connection, and apparently they are college pals from back in the day. And it's here that they establish that Robert's ex-wife is in England, without going into the details of the divorce, whether, you know, there might have been issues with steroids, sexual performance. I don't know. I'm only inferring that from, you know, Lyle Alzado's real life. And Carol is kind of, she's not really picking up the vibe that Robert is laying down, which is that of a very stern no.
But I'm here studying you. How about a makeup exam?
You know, that cop should have pulled you in.
I mean, she is totally into him. I mean, you can read that loud and clear by the way she looks at him, the way she talks to him. So I don't know what Robert is doing to kind of meet his sexual needs, and maybe I'm reading a little too much into this. You know, as a single dad, I don't know where he's going for that sort of companionship. So I think if this show had lasted longer than it did, I think it was inevitable that these two were going to get it on at some point, because eventually he was going to crack. Unless, of course, in his wrestling career as the Masked Maniac, he runs into some rats on the road, which I don't know about that, because I don't think this show would necessarily explore that kind of culture. I'd like to say that maybe the next scene is a little bit less sexual, but you can certainly infer some of it, because we meet Ellen's friend Beth, who wants a few more piercings in her ears. Apparently, she's got multiples already and wants to get, you know, just one more. And this was a simpler time back in the late 80s. She's not out looking for a tongue piercing or a hood piercing or anything like that. She just wants one more ear piercing. And there's plenty of places to go at the mall back then for that sort of thing. But also, she's got hormones running wild like any sort of high school student.
Oh, here comes Kevin and your brother. Oh, isn't he cute? I'd like to lock lips with him.
Oh, that's a graphic.
Hi, I'm thinking of getting another hole in my ear.
Go for it.
This is going to sound weird because, you know, these girls are not 18, but I just got to tell it like it is. And it's that kind of a bold choice by these producers to make the boy hungry girl the by far the less attractive one between her and Ellen, because Ellen, I think, is definitely better looking. Also, she has glasses, and when you had glasses in a 1980s sitcom, you're never going to be portrayed as the better looking one. That, and in movies, you got to take off the glasses, let the hair go down, and all that. I know, it's a cliched scene, but that's just the way things were done back then. I think this might be some kind of Stockholm Syndrome thing for me watching this show multiple times, but I think I might steal some of that bumper music. It's very soothing. It works well between the segments. Maybe a little cheesy for a sitcom, but again, this is 1988, so I suppose it works for the time. So now, cut to home, and Mark and his friend Brad are watching wrestling. They're doing it in a way where they're sitting on the couch and they're completely overacting to what's going on. It's not any way that anybody you would know or yourself would watch wrestling. Like, I don't sit here and watch the 1991 Royal Rumble and go, yeah, yeah, get him, you know, all that. Or, you know, even Monday Night Raw, although, you know, I watch it weirdly because I often record this podcast while it's on mute, so I really can't comment on what's going on. So, okay, I'll accept that you have to overact like that for TV. And on that TV is a match between the Masked Maniac and Ric Flair, which... Now, I was kind of wondering about the Masked Maniac spot on the card for this particular promotion, and I have a number of questions about that, because in part of my research, it describes him as a jobber to the stars, but yet he's facing Ric Flair, he's facing Arn Anderson later, so I don't know, I'll explore that in a little bit. But he gets Flair in the ropes and hits him in the eyes and starts raking his eyes with sandpaper. That's not a move that you'd really see in 1988. Like, who the hell is he, Gaylord Perry with sandpaper, and using that to cheat? And by the way, you're going to be shocked when Flair takes an Irish whip to the corner, he comes out and they do the press slam spot that you would see in every Flair Sting match, every Flair Luger match from this very time period. And here he's doing it with the Masked Maniac, who, of course, that is not Lyle Alzado in the ring, because you have to have an actual trained wrestler to make this look good. And they use Dr. Death Steve Williams for that, who gets a credit at the end of the show as Dr. Death. Not Steve Williams, but Dr. Death, because we have to, you know, I guess hide that fact. So Mark and Brad, they're kind of discussing the rumors that they may have heard of the Masked Maniac. And thankfully, it's not one of those where, yeah, it's actually David Von Erich didn't die, and it's him returning under a mask, you know, like all that Ultimate Warrior stuff.
You know, that Masked Maniac is a total animal. You know, I heard he's puppies for lunch.
I can assure you that if that line was in a sitcom today, PETA would immediately be up the ass of whoever the hell the writers and producers of the program was. This is where we see the Flair flip in the corner from the opening sequence, where he falls onto the apron. He doesn't do the run to the opposite corner thing, so that would be a little too advanced for this show. And then he gets suplexed back into the ring. Now, Mark's sister Ellen walks into the living room, and being as though she's underage, she's not going to be riding on Space Mountain anytime soon. However, she's very unimpressed by the storytelling she's seeing in this match.
I can't believe you guys are watching this junk.
This is not junk. This is a professional sport.
Oh, yeah, right. It's right up there with chess.
It's a shame that Ellen is comparing it unfavorably with chess, saying that this is not intellectual, when, in fact, we're going to see some of the guys in this locker room are pretty intellectual after all, with very humorous results. But we cut now to a marquee which says NWA Wrestling Tonight, because you can't just say NWA Tonight, because it could be the rap group, and that would be something completely different that I don't know there would be much crossover in the audience. Again, I don't know where this is. It's not something where, okay, this is definitely in Canada, even though it is a Canadian production. It's ironic, because, of course, the NWA is not running Canada, that this is actually a Canadian show. But we get a real treat here. and Ric Flair, who has just dispatched the Masked Maniac. We don't actually get to see the pinfall because we have to protect the Masked Maniac going forward. We can't just show him getting beat every week because then people will stop tuning in to learning the ropes because then they'll figure out that he's not learning anything between the ropes. But Ric Flair getting to cut a promo on a sitcom is... This is so amazing.
Great display tonight, Rick. Once again, you showed why you're one of the great ones.
Bernie, a wrestler's my life, pal.
And the way you annihilated the Masked Maniac. An awesome display of human destruction.
Like I said, killing's my luck. Brutal murder's my life.
That speakerphone leg lock you applied tonight. I've never seen the Maniac in...
Torture's my life. Inflicting horrible pain and agony is my life.
8 years from now, when people look back at their career of Ric Flair, what do you think they'll say about you?
That in my own small way, I managed to improve the quality of life. Woo!
I love that so much, even though Flair calls himself a murderer, and there's only one true murderer in the Four Horsemen, but we'll put that aside and just say, Ric Flair is certainly one of the greatest of all time on promos, and this proves to me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that he would work in today's environment of completely scripted promos, because he took this somewhat hacky stuff and really made it work for his character. I mean, even the stuff about, like, murder. Okay, I will accept that Ric Flair is a murderer. He is a killer. He likes torturing people. It's basically Ric Flair delivering your standard Mr. Fuji promo and somehow making it sound logical. Oh, that is so great. But I don't... There's a couple things I don't understand about this, and it's that... Is Flair a babyface in this promotion? Because that was not a babyface promo, and I know that the Masked Maniac is not a babyface. Are they running heel versus heel? There's so much about whatever the hell this promo... I mean, it's the NWA, and I'd assume that they are, you know, saying that it is Jim Crockett Promotions because it still existed at this point. But I'm a little curious about the mechanics of this particular promotion. Like, how is the Maniac always on every week? Why are they running the area in which they are? Is this school in the Carolinas? Well, why do all the actors have Canadian accents? So we cut to the locker room, and the Masked Maniac walks in, and we see former NWA World Heavyweight Champion Ronnie Garvin there, and his towel is there too to greet him, and Ronnie wants to say thank you to the Masked Maniac for loaning him a book.
Here's that book you gave me on the French Revolution. I found it interesting. When people are oppressed and destitute, they're able to bind together to create constructive change. The human spirit rises to meet any challenge it needs to survive. Good analysis.
I don't understand why the audience is so shocked by that. I mean, it's basically like that Boston Symphony Orchestra recording from the day Kennedy was shot, where the conductor announces that they're going to play the funeral march, and these people didn't know that JFK was dead. I don't think it's quite to that level, but the crowd's like, oh my God. Well, all right, but I need to put that aside, because we know that the Masked Maniac is Robert Randall, and I need to focus on Ronnie Garvin's acting, starting with how he pronounces the word interesting.
Interesting.
I mean, I guess phonetically it is interesting. I mean, but I just have never heard anybody actually say it that way. Ronnie Garvin, this kind of just proves that his acting is as stiff as he is as a worker. God almighty. I mean, you're got a pilot for this show, and you're going to roll out Ronnie Garvin as your guy in that locker room. Although, I have to give him credit, because I don't know when they taped this, but he's in the heel locker room, and he only had his heel turned at the Great American Bash. They turned it on Dusty and give him the hands of stone. So I don't think there was, you know, that kind of foresight in booking, especially Dusty Rhodes, JCP, 1988. I think it's just coincidence, and he happened to be a guy that was there. Hey, just for the same reasons that he won the world title in the first place. It's also interesting. Interesting. You know what else is ProWrestlingOnly.com. Go there to explore other podcasts and match reviews, features and retrospectives, reviews of wrestling books, video games, and matches. playlists, wrestler appearances in non-wrestling TV shows and movies and more, or even wrestling-related TV shows, such as, you know, Ronnie Garvin's acting. Join the conversation by signing up at the Pro Wrestling Only forums, online for over a decade with over 2,000 registered members and an archive of 2.35 million threads. Our message board is a vibrant community, whether you want to talk about a specific match in the match discussion archive, take a deep dive in the microscope form, or discuss more general topics from wrestling's past and present. Check it all out at ProWrestlingOnly.com.
And the crowd is cherishing every moment. Morton in the corner. Silver, folks, it's been a great ride. The Whalers will go out winners.
It was totally inevitable that it was going to happen, but still a great shame that the Hartford Whalers were moved to Carolina. Of course, that was happening all across the NHL. You got Quebec moving to Colorado, which I suppose you can understand because Denver, a much bigger market, and the Canadian dollar and all that. Winnipeg Jets moving to Phoenix. But this one hit home for me because right at the point where I get a driver's license to go to Hartford to actually see these games, now all of a sudden, you know, they've packed up and moved to Carolina. Just another case of greed. And I wish that they could have left the team name and colors behind. I feel like that's a good policy. You know, you're starting fresh in a new city. Don't pretend like you're the Whalers by, you know, wearing their jerseys 20 years later. I know that the last season that the Whalers were around, the Bruins were terrible in 97. So I watched Whalers games in 97 because while they didn't make the playoffs either, and their season concluded with their last regular season game in Hartford, a win over Tampa Bay, I was not only showing tribute to the Hartford Whalers by actually washing them. I got a Whalers jersey for my birthday that year. I don't know if it still fits. It probably does not reach my waist anymore. It was a little small on me then. And also, I'd like to sign my name on my papers senior year, where the W in my last name I would draw into a Whalers logo, because I was already into college and I really didn't give a crap at that point. So back to learning the ropes. Ellen needs some money for lunch, so what she does is she works that bit that you may remember from the opening theme of The Jetsons, where Jane, his wife, and George holds out, you know, a couple of dollars, and she takes the whole wallet instead and leaves him with the couple of dollars. Kind of a dick move by Jane, quite frankly. Robert only has a $5, so Ellen takes it, and he demands change back, at which she just laughs in his face. So I can kind of tell that Ellen is the favorite child of Robert, just from kind of the interplay. And Alzado keeps delivering all of his lines bug-eyed, and it's really starting to bother me a little bit. As it turns out, Mark held him up on driving to school, because Robert was going to give his kid a ride, but instead he says, oh, I've got a ride by somebody else. So clearly, ne'er-do-well son, and this is why Robert likes his daughter better and is willing to let her get away with a little bit more. So now he's looking for his tennis racket for whatever reason, and he goes into the closet and he finds a mask on the floor. And he looks at it and he notices that, oh yes, this is the Masked Maniac's mask. And he starts doing the math in his head where, like, dad was out. The Maniac wrestled last night. Where did dad go? We don't know. So it's this slow process where, yeah, he figures out finally that his dad is the Masked Maniac.
Dad was out last night. Come to think of it, Dad's been out a lot lately. I don't believe it. My father's an animal.
Well, he's not Animal Steel, but I guess an animal in a different sense. I gotta say, I'm a little impressed with the Masked Maniac's commitment to the business, because he's working a full-time day job as a teacher at this prep school, but yet he's taking all these bookings that are presumably on weeknights also. So he's working in the ring multiple times per week, and I don't know how far this territory goes, but he has to be getting back home every night. So I have not extrapolated where this is geographically. Maybe this is going to be one of those Simpsons things where they'll eventually drop hints. I don't know. So we cut to school now, and Mark's pals are there, and they're talking about the match between the Masked Maniac and Ric Flair. And Mark kind of interrupts, and we get, you're not going to believe this, but a couple of wrestling fans get into an argument over the merits of somebody.
So funny.
Oh, nothing. We're just talking about the beating the Masked Maniac got last night.
Yeah, can't win them all.
That creep shouldn't win any.
Not that bad.
I bet they make him wear that mask because he's so ugly.
As usual, Brad, you don't know what you're talking about.
Wait a minute. Since when did you become a supporter of such a loser?
He's not a loser.
I heard he lives with a gorilla.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I think I've figured out that this doesn't take place in Philadelphia or that area because it's very hard, I guess, for a heel fan to exist. And I think it was in general in the when kayfabe was being kept, you know, up to the late 80s. So I guess this is on the edge of that. You know, you couldn't really cheer for the heel unless you were in Philadelphia, I think, because that's something that's always been a sort of tradition there. Ric Flair, again, is he a babyface in this world? So it's kind of fulfilling my dream of him having an extended babyface run. I don't quite understand it, but Principal Mallory sees Mark shoving his pals and drags him by the ear into his dad's classroom, which I thought was a little strange, but again, this is a private school. You can get away with a little bit more. Normally you can't put hands on the students, but this is a little different in that, you know, it's the son of faculty. So you can do something by dragging a kid by his ear like it's 1952. So Robert, because it's his kid, requests to handle this himself in his own way.
All right, you want to talk?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk. As you remember, last time we spoke, I was looking for our tennis racket in the closet. What do you think I found?
Well, if it was your closet, probably a 50-pound fungus.
Now, that's a sick burn there by Dad. The only problem is, what he doesn't know is that Mark has him by the balls.
I found a mask.
A mask?
Not just any kind of mask. The Masked Maniac's mask. Wonder how it got there.
A mask?
Yeah, a mask fits over your head.
Oh, that mask! Halloween, I wore it.
Dad, last Halloween we passed out jawbreakers all night. No mask.
Maybe it was Easter.
Maybe you're not telling me everything. Now, come on.
Well, I like how Robert takes a few beats to actually think of an excuse in his head. The fact that he went right to Easter masks then caused me to Google Easter masks, and then I became very frightened by the bunny mask that I saw, and I'm probably going to have nightmares about that. I think, in analyzing it, and I know it's 2020 hindsight here, he should have said that it was an old friend of his who gave him the mask as a souvenir, because it's not something he could have bought, and plus he's anti-wrestling anyway, although I think that that might play into not believing that the Masked Maniac is an old pal of his. Or he could say that, you know, he met him at the gym, or something like that. Because there was no merchandise back then. Like, you couldn't buy masks at, like, the merch table for the conquistadors or something like that. But, okay. So now he's stuck. And basically, he's now got to cut a deal with his own kid, and he's got to confess to the whole thing.
I see you put this together.
Sure did. Mr. Maniac, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry you had to find out this way.
Sorry, Dad, I think it's cool.
Mark shows a lot of flawed logic here, where he thinks that being the Masked Maniac's son will help him get girls somehow, even though, like, to take his own sister as an example, she's repulsed by the whole notion of wrestling. And I don't know if she's one of the cool kids or anything like that, but I would find it hard to believe in 1988 into 1989 that the popular girls at school, now I wasn't in high school then, I was in, you know, late elementary school, but let's just say I don't think it was a boy's thing to watch pro wrestling. So I don't quite understand why he thinks that would increase his popularity with women. I mean, he might just be a horn dog and thinks that anything positive could. The problem is that nobody can know about this, because apparently this dude's traveling all over the territory and then somehow making it back to school every single weekday after working shots the night before. So if, you know, if you get busted doing that, they'll fire you from your teaching job, which is something that Robert, you know, calmly explains to his kid. So his career as a teacher, which is what he wants to be, is at stake. The whole wrestling thing, oh yeah, this is a side thing, okay? This is not the boyhood dream or anything like that. This is to earn cash, as he explains. And now this makes him very relatable. It makes him sound incredibly noble, a single dad out hustling for the benefit of his two wisecracking teenage kids.
A friend of mine at the health club asked me if I wanted to make some extra money wrestling. He said I could fill in, because one of the regulars had dropped out. You know, I did it for the kicks. I had fun. But more importantly, I was able to put some money away for college for you and Ellen. You know, when I was a kid, I had no shots. I could do it all on my own. And you and Ellen are going to get an education. And that is why I wrestle, Mark. Now, do you understand that?
I should also make the point, maybe I made this earlier in the show, I can't even remember, but private school pays less than public school, so the odds are that he would want to supplement his income in some way. See, these days, somebody could take up, like, I don't know, a knitting habit and sell stuff on Etsy or something like that. Here, he's going to go out because he's a big dude and can apparently wrestle, but once again, it raises the question to me of, where exactly did he get his formal training from? It's not like he had a New England Pro Wrestling Academy to go to and to get trained. It seems like they pulled him out of the gym and just threw him into the ring, which doesn't seem to make sense. So kind of a hole in the story, I think, there, along with the, you know, how is he getting back to being teaching in school if he's working legitimately on weeknights, because it seems like that Flair match was on a weeknight because there was school the next day. So, I don't know. There's a number of things that I can't figure out. Of course, there's also plenty of stuff that Mark doesn't know.
So what's Andre the Giant really like?
Jesus, Mark, aren't you paying attention to the product? You're watching the NWA on television, and have you happened to notice that Andre the Giant is not in the same promotion as the Masked Maniac, who's in the NWA, and Andre, everybody knows that he's exclusive to the WWF post-1984-85, except for, you know, shots in Japan? What a stupid Mark. And I hate to use that term, but his actual name is Mark, so I can call him a dumb Mark and have it not be, you know, in that normal pejorative way. So now they're eating dinner in the kitchen of the house, and Mark now doesn't want to wash the dishes, and I'm liking him less and less as this show goes along. He's like blackmailing people. He doesn't want to do chores. He's basically lazy. He like mouthed off to a girl who's trying to be nice to him. I mean, there's a lot not to like about this guy, and he's pretty much coasting on the goodwill I have for the actor himself from the movie Hockey Night. So Ellen, this is how that household is working, because of the whole single dad thing, is Ellen cooks, and she's very proud of doing that for this family unit, and Robert, of course, is the one that provides. So Mark has to do something, and that should be cleaning the dishes. But instead, he's dreaming of a girl from school and doesn't want to do the dishes.
Hey, I love you guys, I really do. But right now, 6 blocks away at the library in the biography section, the table on the right is the most gorgeous creature I've ever seen.
Well, I'm impressed. At least you found out there's a library.
Thank you, Ellen. I need this sumbitch taken down a few pegs, quite frankly, after some of his actions in this episode. Ellen has the freshman dance coming up, and she'd like to get a new dress for it. And, of course, that will require money from her dad. So Mark, being the complete wise ass that he is, decides to take this opportunity to just make a bunch of puns and make light of the situation that he's blackmailing his dad for.
Ellen, can't you see the stress you're putting on Dad? I mean, every month he has to wrestle with the bills.
Eat your dinner.
I already ate, Dad.
Then eat your napkin.
I wouldn't want to see you pinned in some corner. You know I'd go to the mat for you.
I thought you were going to the library.
Hey, I'm a sensitive guy. I wouldn't want to see our needs as children putting a stranglehold on you.
I'm going to put a stranglehold on you.
Wait a minute, what's going on here?
Mark's really a dick. I mean, I feel like later on, if he had a friend who was closeted and gay, that he would just out the person by making like a bunch of innuendo, Terry Garvin School of Self-Defense jokes or whatever he might have heard. I don't know. I really am liking him less and less. So Robert asks to have a private talk with his son, so tells Ellen to go take a powder, and tells Mark that he is not exactly the Sultan of Subtlety. Which, not exactly the greatest Dire Straits song. I prefer Walk of Life. But finally, he intimidates Mark into actually doing the dishes, despite his fears of wrecking his hands with dishwater or something like that. So, yeah, the parenting via intimidation probably isn't ideal, but it's the only way to get through to this punk what needs to be done. But meanwhile, back at the ranch, literally at home, Ellen wants to know what her dad is up to, because she suspects that something's up. She smells a rat, but she's not entirely sure what. But she thinks now that Mark knows what is going on. So one good blackmail attempt deserves another, and then another, and when that doesn't work, she goes for a third one.
Won't everybody be interested to read those love letters you wrote to Cindy Harrison, but never sent?
I don't care about those letters. She can't read.
Tell all your friends that 19-year-old waitress you supposedly met on that cruise we went on was really 8 years old and you played checkers with her.
Could have lied to something.
Mark, if you don't tell me where Dad is, I'm telling all your friends at school you pasted hair on your chest.
I have concerns about how this family operates as a unit when all they seem to be doing is blackmailing each other to get what they want. I feel like that's not healthy in the long run, and if he actually had any money, they would go see a therapist. But instead, the two kids, they go to wrestling now, so now the scene is a wrestling ring, and the masked maniac is once again taking on Arn Anderson, which makes me wonder, is he feuding with the Four Horsemen? And if he is, wouldn't he be getting better payoffs because he's facing higher profile guys? Could this guy ever get on a pay-per-view, even though it's relatively new for Jim Crockett Promotions, the NWA, at that time? So Ellen and Mark, they take a seat in the stands as the maniac misses at S.T. Jones Memorial Charge, and Arn tosses the masked maniac through the middle rope, and Mark kind of, he just decides he's going to go down to the locker room. And Ellen is in the crowd just kind of covering her face, completely mortified. I'm not sure if, I guess it would be because her dad is a wrestler and not because he is a jobber wrestler who is basically getting pinned by the Four Horsemen on a regular basis. But Ellen goes down to the hallway now for this confrontation with her dad. And it's time for a little heart-to-heart. Daddy-daughter.
Well, I probably should have told you.
Yeah, you probably should have.
Well, I was worried you'd be upset.
I am upset, but I could have handled it. I'm not a little helpless girl.
I know you're not helpless.
I have a right to know what's going on. I don't want to wake up one morning and find out I don't have a father anymore either.
We have to get on with our lives now.
And that now includes having a father named the masked maniac?
Yes, it does.
Look, honey, he is trying to make enough money doing this so that you can eventually go to college. In case you haven't noticed, in the late 80s, the price of college is rising exponentially at that time. So he's got to make every single dollar count. And he's got to be under a mask. I'm sorry, it's a fact of life. Now, the masked maniac is a little basic, but hell, he could have ended up as one of the freaking ding-dongs. Rest in peace, Jim Evans, who passed away this past week. But it's good that Ellen at least kind of shows the maturity to know that this is kind of a necessary evil. We have one earner in this family, so he's taking on a second job to help make ends meet. So now we go into the locker room where when Ellen and Robert walk in there, they Ronnie Garvin has Mark over his head. Now, I don't recall Ronnie Garvin doing a lot of military presses, although he was one of the early guys to slam Andre the Giant, something that is not particularly well known. But he has Mark way up in the air in the press slam position, and Mark is talking about the view from up there. There is also another wrestler in the room. Some guy named Cheetah is there as well. But what makes this so great is it's another chance for Ronnie Garvin to show off those acting chops.
Nice kids. Your father's quite a guy. We call him the professor. That's because he's a teacher, you know.
Yeah, that job I knew about.
He's helping me with my master's degree, and he's helping me write my book.
You're writing a book?
Yeah, it's a spy book, and it's kind of autobiographical. It's called I Led Nine Lives.
There's something great about Ronnie Garvin pursuing a master's degree, like he's at the Harvard Business School or something like that. But the Cheetah, in talking about writing a book, this guy was way ahead of the curve in terms of wrestlers writing books. I mean, this is a good decade before Mick Foley kind of paved the way for every wrestler to kind of write a memoir. He and Garvin now leave the locker room because it's time for their match or something, I would hope, since Garvin isn't dressed. He's in his green tights with the no knee pads and all that. But it's time for the tag of the show. Not a tag match, but in the world of sitcoms, the tag is that little thing at the end of the show where you might do like a 1 minute, you know, blurb, vignette, whatever, with like a final joke. You'd see it in every episode of the Brady Bunch where, you know, they just kind of wrap up the episode. Maybe Alice would make a wise crack and they'd all maybe hug or something like that, just to kind of close things out. So, and I'm very comfortable with that format, but they don't take like a commercial break and then come back to it. So it's kind of all wrapped up in this scene. And it's about Robert laying down the law with regards to his kids in this career and this world that he exists in.
This is my other job and these are my friends. And now both you and Ellen know, but you both got to keep this a secret. Do you understand that?
Oh, right. Like I want the whole world to know about this.
See, I don't really care how cliched and hacky the writing is as long as it sticks to a certain formula, like the hug at the end of the episode as the credits start to roll. But before they actually play the closing credits theme song, we get the little sha-la-la-la thing that they would do on Learning the Ropes. I mean, this is not a good show by any means, but if you're going to evoke family ties like they are at certain points, I mean, that's fine with me. As long as it's not that weird thing they did on Family Ties where Andrew is born and then all of a sudden the next season he's 5 years old, but the rest of them all stayed the same age. That always kind of bugged me about Family Ties. Since we are at the end of the show, I do want to play the closing credits theme, since you know I'm a huge fan of that.
Don't forget to tune in for some cool music and all the cartoon friends of the coolest cat in town, DJ Cat, on everybody's favorite, The DJ Cat Show, Sunday mornings at 9 on Fox 5.
I don't know what that is. Learning the ropes, sha-la-la-la. Yeah, Fox 5. Ooh, nice little thing at the end. Fox 5. That could be Washington, D.C. It could be New York City. I don't know, and I really don't care. That's a wrap for the pilot episode of Learning the Ropes, entitled Unmasking the Masked Maniac.
And Boggs is always out here before the game, play and catch, working on his knuckleball. And probably looking forward to this opportunity to finally get in the game and use it. Yeah, he's looking forward to it.
The pressure's on now. He's a runner in scoring position. Yeah.
And this guy's got a quick stroke.
He's going to strike him out.
Got him. His first major league strikeout. And Wade Boggs has pitched a scoreless eighth inning to bring a smile to the face. And he tips his cap.
I didn't dig that one out to pick on the Yankees per se, other than I found it really fun that they let Wade Boggs pitch and go out there and throw knuckleballs against the Angels in what would turn out to be his final season with the Yankees. He'd go on to the Tampa Bay Devil Rays for the final 2 years of his career. But yeah, he pitches a scoreless eighth inning and in the process saves the Yankee bullpen. I think they were losing that game 12-4. And they had a doubleheader the next day against the Angels. So it was pretty imperative to, you know, conserve the bullpen as much as they possibly could. And they ended up sweeping that doubleheader the next day. But, of course, the 97 Yankees would have to settle for the AL wild card as they would be unable to catch the wire-to-wire 1997 Baltimore Orioles, who would lose the American League Championship Series to Cleveland. And the less said about that World Series, the better, because there's not a lot positive to speak of, other than I loved that Game 4. It snowed in the pregame. I think that was the one. Yeah, but anyway, if I had malice towards the Yankees, I would have dug out the Mariano Rivera blown save in Game 4 of the ALDS against Cleveland when he gave up the home run to Sandy Alomar Jr. But I didn't do that. I brought up a fun moment with Wade Boggs. So anyway, in other podcasts, my Adams Division podcast partner Steve Bennett and the Sportscasters is on a hiatus now between seasons, but do check out his feed for an extensive catalog of great interviews. Jane Levy, Jeff Perlman, Joe Buck, the list goes on and on. His Rolodex continues to amaze me, although he probably doesn't have an actual Rolodex because it's all electronic now. On the Our Vantage Point podcast with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, there's some good Saturday Night's Main Event talk in their opening segment this week. That's something right in Mr. Pete's wheelhouse. And Saturday Night Main Event and doing all those shows on the Place to Be podcast over the last year plus, and on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brian Milanos. Brian and Mike Mills of the Book in the Territory podcast debate old school versus new school wrestling. And I'm sure Crockett was a fair and impartial moderator, a Jim Lehrer, if you will, for this. Although, as I recall, Jim Lehrer did a terrible job on one of the presidential debates. I don't know what year. It might have been 2012 that I'm thinking of. Probably not, because that was the year I purposely did not watch a single one of any of the debates, because I think two or three of them happened when I was on vacation on the West Coast, and it was nice to avoid that sort of stuff. But I still have a little bit more to get to, and I want to do a quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this is actually from a different Learning the Ropes video, but I feel it's important to kind of gather these comments on this show. As always, these are actual comments left by YouTube users on the site. Under a different video, it's a Learning the Ropes, it says TV pilot, but it is a different episode with Ivan Koloff in it. So we'll start out with James Salazzo says, Stoffman left Degrassi for this. Hey, we all make our choices in life, leaving gigs, going to another one. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work out. I'm coming to the end of a 90-day contract at where I work now, and I assume that I'll be working there a month from now on a full-time basis, but you never know what might happen tomorrow. I mean, apparently they can't offer me anything for another couple weeks, so I'm very confused at what's going on. Corey Williams says, Saturday, 11 a.m. on Fox 5, New York. So I guess that answers the question of where this tape had come from. N2K Master says, man, glad you got a copy of that when you did. Looks like either the VCR or tape was just about to go. And yeah, I watched it here in Eastern Canada for only a short period of time on ATV, which is now CTV. Maybe saw a grand total of four or five of the shows. Why was it so cool back then? The teen bopper era, where Saved by the Bell is the hot ticket, New Kids on the Block were it. That was the genre back then, and finding wrestling on rabbit ears as a child was like finding gold, even if it was mashed into a crappy comedy. And I agree with all those sentiments. Rick James, not the real Rick James, says, I used to watch this show. I don't even know if it made it all the way through the first season. Well, it depends. They probably only ordered 13 episodes up front and then would order more if it was successful. So that's why you probably only end up with 13. Scott Simpson says, I was in the studio audience for the episode with Ivan Koloff. By the end of the taping, most of the audience had left. The laughter here is 100% canned. Well, that is pretty normal for sitcoms. There are ones that would use the actual studio audience laughter, like, for example, a Seinfeld or a Married with Children. And Married with Children is a real problem at certain points. It would get a little too rowdy. But by the end of the taping, most of the audience had left. What is this, SmackDown Live, where they're trying to do 205 Live afterwards? Something like that. Jessica and Ricky said, bad 80s TV. I mean, this is simply unwatchable. Why did we think it was so cool back then? And Billy Cross replies, I love bad 80s TV. The dumber, the better. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As we're now into the new year, I also need to add one more segment in addition to YouTube Comment Theater. And I only did this once during the regular season. Yes, it is time to bring back Vinny Vegas Corner. So yes, in the abbreviated picks season, I think I made picks in week one and went 1-2, and then just never did it again for the remaining 16 weeks of the NFL season. So let me just go quickly around Wild Card Weekend. Saturday afternoon, 4:35 Eastern, we have the Indianapolis Colts visiting the Houston Texans. I like Indianapolis getting 1.5 points because the Colts should have won that division. If you flash back to week four, they're playing at home against Houston, and they stupidly go for it in their own territory late in overtime with the misguided notion of, we don't want to play for the tie, we want to try to win this game. Well, it ended up backfiring because Houston gets the ball and then immediately kicks a field goal. They end up winning the game. If they had they gotten a tie out of that game, they would have ended up actually winning the division with a record of 10-5-1. Houston would have also been 10-5-1, but they would have had the tiebreaker based on winning the game in Houston later in the season. I guess, you know, there's a butterfly effect and all, but, you know, I'll just assume that everything would have turned out the same. I'm impressed with how quickly the Colts turned things around. And yes, a lot of it had to do with Andrew Luck's shoulder woes the last couple of years. I hate the Colts. I hate them with a passion for obvious reasons, given their role in certain things that happened to my team, the New England Patriots. They were also first in the league on third down conversions on offense this year, which I feel like is a pretty relevant stat, you know, for extending drives and that sort of thing. So I like the Colts getting 1.5 in that one. We got the Dallas Cowboys hosting the Seattle Seahawks in prime time on the East Coast. 8-something on Saturday night or thereabouts. Dallas, kind of a sneaky good home team over the course of the regular season. 7-1 at home. And they shut down the Saints. And that was the game that kind of proved to me that Dallas was capable of winning a whole home game. They are defensively solid, and I owe them one after using them in Madden 18 and defeating my 8-year-old nephew in that against all odds. But also, I want to point out to everybody that this game is the Battle of the Clappers, where you got Jason Garrett facing off against Pete Carroll. Although, I don't think Pete Carroll claps as much as he did when he was the coach of the Patriots. He may have learned. Plus, he's older than you think he is. Pete Carroll's almost 70 years old. That's just crazy to me. So Dallas giving 1.5 in that one is the pick. Sunday afternoon, we got Baltimore hosting the Los Angeles Chargers in a 1 o'clock game for the West Coast team. Maybe not the most fair thing in the world, but again, keep up my theme of good defense plays in January. And yeah, the Chargers have some guys on, you know, the other side of the ball, but the Ravens traditionally have always had a very good defense. But also, the city of Baltimore, Charm City, is owed karmically after living through the 2018 Baltimore Orioles. Ravens win 10 games during the regular season. I think it took until May 15th for the Orioles to get to 10 wins. And quite honestly, because I picked Indianapolis to beat Houston, I think now we're certainly destined for another Baltimore versus Patriots playoff game, because those do tend to be thrillers, except for the one where Baltimore marched in and blew out the Patriots by scoring 24 points in the first quarter. I hope there's no repeat of that. So Baltimore Ravens giving 3 points to the Los Angeles Chargers. And I didn't say San Diego Chargers. I'm glad I didn't slip up. I didn't even need a note like Troy Aikman needed on his little computer in front of him that one game. And then finally, we have the Chicago Bears hosting the Philadelphia Eagles at the Soldier Field Spaceship, giving 6 points in that one. And once again, defense in January. It plays in any sort of weather, you may name it. And Philly, they're so banged up at this point, and I'm willing to take a step back and say, look, they defended their Super Bowl title with honor, 9-7, probably not what they wanted in defensive. They worked really hard to get into the playoffs, but they're a really banged up team going against that defense. I mean, Foles probably isn't 100%. I am not a fan of Mitchell Trubisky for a number of different reasons other than, you know, because I think he looks to run too quickly instead of actually looking down the field. He doesn't have a good set of quarterback eyes, if you know what I mean, where he sees his receivers. He just will put his head down and run way too fast, way too often. That's a recipe to get injured, but I don't think it'll matter on this day. I am picking the Chicago Bears, giving 6 to the Philadelphia Eagles. So the roundup of picks: Indianapolis +1.5, Dallas -1.5, Baltimore -3, and Chicago -6 for Vinny Vegas Corner. As for a show next week, stay tuned to social media on that, because I need to get my feet back under me from all the traveling, going to Long Island, going to Indiana this past week. So everything has been kind of put together for this show rather quickly and in chunks. I mean, when I'm recording on the road, you know, it's a little different than going down to the basement studio and all that. But I'll have something out next Thursday that is probably fairly traditional for episode 98, although I do hope to do another episode of Learning the Ropes. This might be something good to revisit in the future, where maybe I don't necessarily have to run down the entire history of the series, but this was certainly a lot of fun, revisiting all the sitcom tropes and stuff like that. I do have a lot of things in my queue to work through. Maybe I should do one with Ronnie Garvin in it, since he was such a delight on this show, but we shall see. As I said, stay tuned on social media, Facebook, and on Twitter, at GF Allentown Pod. Be sure to give me a follow there and give 5 stars on your review on Apple Music /iTunes, because that provides what is known as social proof that you are enjoying and listening to this podcast. And do tell a friend when, you know, somebody asks, oh, what wrestling podcasts are good? You would say Greetings from Allentown. Of course you would, because you're listening to me right now, stalling for time in the finest Larry Zbyszko tradition. But I am going to cut it off right there and tell you that you should tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Like I said, killing's my life. Brutal murder's my life.